Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to start our program today by talking with you about how to break that cycle of debt, build a better financial future in the process. Eric Tyson is our guest. He is one of the nation's best-selling personal finance book authors. I think he sold over 5 million copies of his books. And his newest is Let's Get Real About Money. It's published by FT Press, and really pleased to have him along today. And certainly, if you have questions about your financial future, how to invest, maybe about debt and getting out of it, give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And if my voice cracks a little bit today, it's because I picked up another cold. Eric Tyson with us by phone. Eric, hi. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, Larry, thanks for having me on.
The majority of Americans carry too much consumer debt. I think most of us do. If you have a credit card debt or auto loans, boy, you're not alone. And I'm wondering how healthy it is to carry consumer debt and how much consumer debt should somebody be carrying?
Well, I'll give you my answer, and it's not the answer that the credit card companies will give you or the auto loan companies or the banks, and that, you know, there's the correct amount of consumer debt to carry, the healthy amount of consumer debt to carry is none.
Mm-hmm.
Consumer debt is the financial equivalent of cancer, and like cancer, when you get it, you have it, you need to come up with a decisive plan to get rid of it as quickly as possible. And the problem being that it grows at a fast rate. It's at high interest rates. That interest is not at all tax deductible. And the longer you carry consumer debt, the more it's going to hamper you from saving money and accomplishing your other personal and financial goals.
Yeah, I wonder, some years back I carried consumer debt, credit card debt for a long time. I finally got myself out of it. And for many years now, we use credit cards, but we always pay at the end of the month. So we pay off our cards regardless of how painful it might be. Some months it's more painful than others. But I wonder how many people actually do that.
Most of the surveys that I've seen, about half of all Americans carry debt on their credit cards month to month. That's not an insignificant portion. I mean, the population is very segmented. I mean, there are actually people, and I talk about this in Let's Get Real About Money, there are actually people who save too much. I know that's hard for
I saw that. I read that, and I thought, well, that's not me. I'm sure
right.
of that.
It's not most people, but financial counselors actually see a disproportionate number of people who are kind of oversavers who go to the other extreme. And, look, I'm an advocate of having balance in your life. Saving too much can be a problem. You can drive the other people in your home crazy. You can have a miserly, unhappy existence. On the other hand, if you spend too much and you're living month to month and having the stress of living paycheck to paycheck, getting calls from creditors, that's not much fun either. What this book has is a compilation of strategies and ideas and techniques that can get people to actually change their behavior. And that's the hard part for most people, is actually changing their behavior.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I haven't finished your book yet, but I've read quite pieces of it. And it's I like it because I can understand it.
Mm-hmm.
It's written, and you've got some great examples for people to kind of use as they read through the book. And maybe you could give our listeners just a little thumbnail sketch of what you've got in Let's Get Real About Money.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. When I first started writing financial advice books back more than 10 years ago, I wrote Personal Finance for Dummies, which was the first book in that series that didn't have to do with computers. And I was very attracted to write that book because I really believe that if people learn the principles of sound personal financial management, they could make more informed decisions. But one of the things that I learned and saw over the years of my work as a financial counselor was that, it wasn't enough for people to know what the principles were. A lot of times people's behavior stood in the way. So this book represents what I've learned in the more than decades worth of work that I did as a personal financial counselor So it covers things, you know, for example, the first part of the book gets you to assess your current knowledge and skill level, identify where there may be gaps in your knowledge. It also gets you to reflect upon and think about why you relate to money and think about money in the way that you do. What messages and lessons were taught to you about money growing up? What beliefs do you have about money? Because that can significantly color how you make money decisions today. After that, it goes through a lot of traditional things, you know, doing an inventory of where you're spending your money, compiling your assets and liabilities, and then developing a plan. And that plan can also include talking with loved ones about your plans, finding peace and happiness with your loved ones. That's a huge source of tension and stress in a lot of households. People disagree about money. People have different money personalities. So there's lots of good advice in the book about that. And then how to develop a spending and saving plan, how to get out of debt, and how to make good investments.
Yeah, and it's all there. One of the things I took interest in was how you talked about how men and women handle money differently.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a couple of examples in the book, and I'm trying to remember the examples now, of how you gave a situation and then the A, B, or C, mm-hmm. which would you choose? And then you pointed out that women would choose A, and men would be more likely to choose B or whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, and we certainly know, I mean, the stereotypes that apply, you know, women as a group are far more likely to ask for help and admit gaps in their knowledge than are men. I mean, again, that's a generalization. That's not always true. Men's egos more often get in the way of seeking assistance and education. So when it comes to investing, interestingly, men are more willing to take risks, but that desire sometimes gets them in trouble because they end up chasing after speculative investments and end up losing and not doing as well, not earning the high returns that women tend to.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know what? Every one of our lines is filled.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go to the phones and see what's on people's minds here. Bob in Schulzburg, we'll go to you first. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry, and welcome to the program, Eric.
Thank you.
And I think that you'll be able to answer this question easily enough. My wife and I are senior citizens,
uh-huh.
and we're in good financial shape. We don't have any debt. We own our own home, and let's say we're in pretty decent financial shape.
Okay.
But we've had some, we had five or six CDs at the bank, mm-hmm. and we've been advised by different people that we have investments with. We have investments with what is that called? Linsco Private Ledger,
mm-hmm.
and then Edward Jones,
mm-hmm.
and then we have some money in the bank, and we just purchased a small CD for the University of Wisconsin Credit Union, where we have our Visa card located,
sure. mm-hmm.
and that's the only credit card we have.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we need, and that's all we want.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
What do I think about your investments?
No, just having the one credit card. For us, that gets us by fine, and we just really don't need any other credit card.
It sounds fine to me. I mean, you know, there's really no point to have a lot of credit cards. There's more potential for all sorts of problems the more credit cards you have. So it sounds like you're happy with the current arrangement, and having one, I would say keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, I think you're just fine, Bob. We have in our family, we have two credit cards, and it actually came out to be kind of useful because we had a problem with one card and had to cancel a card,
mm-hmm.
because somebody had tried to charge something on that card that wasn't a member of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had the other card. We happened to be going on a trip, and so it made it handy to have that other card available because we had to cancel the first one.
Well, the other thing you could do, which is kind of related to that idea, is to have a debit card. You know, get a Visa or MasterCard debit card. It's connected to your checking account, and that way, if you find yourself in a situation where, you know, for some reason there's a problem with one of the cards, then you have the other one as a backup. I'm a big fan of debit cards because they prevent people from spending money they don't have and running up big debt balances. You're not in danger of doing that, but we were just talking earlier about all the people who are.
Yeah. Bob, I thank you very much for calling. Sounds like you're on the right track there. David in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
I have a question. I'm 30 years old, and I lost my job due to medical reasons, and I qualified for disability, and it's just temporary thing until I can have things done, but it might be a couple of years. And I had a 401k there, had about $12,000 in it through Fidelity, and I'm just wondering, I had it in a 2040 fund. Do I just leave it in there, or should I try to get that into an IRA, or can I put money even into that with getting? Because I believe you need an earned income, if I'm correct, to add into an IRA.
Mm-hmm. Well, if your employer allows you to leave the money in there, Fidelity is certainly a good firm, and the fund that you're in, the 2040 fund, is a longer term diversified fund, more tilted towards stocks and bonds, and you're investing in stocks worldwide. I certainly think that's a fine place to leave it. So if your employer allows you to do it, that's the path of least resistance, and it's a good fund. If you want to roll it over into your own IRA account, you could do that. The potential benefit of doing that is then you could choose whatever mutual fund or other investment you want to, and if you want to add to your own IRA account, you could do that over time. As you correctly pointed out, you do have to have earned income if you're a single person, to fund that going forward.
Yeah.
Now, I'm married, so would there be a different option that I should be looking at? Because the only thing I'm nervous about with leaving it in the 401k is I just can't add anything to it.
Well, I mean, it shouldn't make you nervous. I mean, it's kind of like one pot of money. If you prefer to have your accounts consolidated. Now, you're married. You can set up a spousal IRA. If your spouse is earning income, but you're not, then your spouse earning income actually qualifies you to contribute to an IRA. You can look at a regular IRA versus a Roth. I would only do the regular IRA if you can get the upfront tax deduction. If you can't, I would do the Roth IRA.
Yeah.
If you want to keep all the money together, that would be the reason to get the money out of the 401k, dump it into your own IRA to which you can contribute going forward.
Yeah. Good luck, David. Thank you very much for calling. Jim in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I had a question about something you were talking about at the start of the program in terms of average debts that people carry.
Yeah.
Seems like for years now, we've been hearing that the average amount of credit card debt is, they've been saying, like $10,000, which makes me scratch my head. And I always wonder, does that include, like, people like ourselves who, we do use a credit card, but we always pay it off. But depending on when they take that snapshot, it could look like we have, before the bill is due, $1,000 to $2,000 worth of credit card debt.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder how that plays out, because otherwise, if they don't include that, I'm thinking, geez, that means a lot of people have really a lot more than $10,000.
Yeah. No, I've seen some of those average numbers thrown around. I've seen them in press releases from organizations that have an axe to grind. Those numbers are not accurate to the extent that they're being portrayed as the average debt balance that consumers are carrying. So your suspicion here is well founded. Most people who have credit card debt do not have more than $2,000 or $3,000 worth, but there are a small percentage of people who carry credit card debt where the balances can get up to $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, $12,000 or more. But they're certainly in the minority.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. Eric Tyson is our guest today. Eric is one of the nation's best-selling personal finance book authors, and his new book, which I've been enjoying reading, is called Let's Get Real About Money, Profit from the Habits of the Best Personal Finance Managers, published by FT Press. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking personal finances today with Eric Tyson, author of Let's Get Real About Money. Pleased to have him along. And I think we have one open line, so you can get in at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Jennifer's on from Manitowoc, so let's go to her next. Jen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am currently a student. I'm graduating from nursing school in May,
okay.
And is my question. My husband and I would like to buy a house in the next year or two. We do have some credit card debt, you know, and like when we get out of school, both of us are students, and, you know, we need to replace our cars and stuff. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, what should be our priority as far as paying off bills, and are student loans going to be a huge detriment in trying to get a home loan and purchase a vehicle and things like that?
Mm-hmm. Eric has lots of good information on home buying and all the things you brought up in his book. But, Eric, what about it?
Yeah, well, great question. And like many people, you've got more things competing for your money than you have money available. the student loans are not nearly as big a concern as consumer debt when it comes to applying for a mortgage. So I would strongly encourage you to make getting rid of the credit card debt priority number one. Priority number two, if you're going to go out and purchase a car, you know, don't go out and buy an expensive car and take out a big car loan. Buy a car that's within your financial means. That may mean buying a used car. Don't assume or think that, well, used cars are going to have more problems. It's not true. There's lots of services like Consumer Reports that evaluate different models of used cars and which ones are good and worth the money and which ones are not. When it comes to buying a home, you've really got to do, you know, this is a great time to do a complete review of your whole financial situation, look at your current spending and budget with an eye towards identifying how much you can really afford on purchasing a home. You should be starting to think about how much money to put away for retirement, and that should factor into your decision as to how much to spend on a home. This is potentially a terrific time for you to be a prospective home buyer because the real estate market in many parts of the country is soft, and it's a good time to buy. There's a sale going on right now, and that's the time to be a buyer.
Okay.
All right. Does that help you out?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jen, for calling. Appreciate it. Nate in Madison, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Nate.
Thanks. Good show. I got a kind of like a two-pronged question here, and this is for my son, who is about 30 years old, and he's married, has no children. He and his wife have a gross income of around $90,000. He has been making a number of investments. He's got a 401k. He's got $50,000 in and through a former employer. He's purchased a 40-acre parcel of land, which he services at about $500 a month. He had just built a new home at about $1,200. The payments are going to be. And one of my questions is, and he also has an ag loan on some farm investment that services itself from the farming. The two questions I have is this. He's just in the process of negotiating this loan for his home, which is a new home. First question would be, when will he know when the interest rates here are sort of going to be at their optimum as far as the decline that's going on right now? Mm-hmm. And the second question would be, how do you, you know, as an older guy here, as his dad, I get kind of nervous about, you know, all of these investments he's got out there. How nervous should I be about this total financial picture here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, great questions. Well, first on the interest rates, as I'm sure you hear all over the news, the Federal Reserve has been pushing down the Fed funds rate, which affects short-term interest rates, the interest rates that are charged on most adjustable-rate mortgages. If he's looking at taking out a fixed-rate mortgage, it doesn't really have that kind of impact. Fixed-rate mortgage rates are determined by long-term interest rates, which are set more by market forces. I can tell you right now that long-term interest rates are at very low levels, and if I were in the market for a mortgage, I would look real long and hard at locking in that fixed rate at such a low attractive rate. And in the scenario where interest rates might even go lower, you could always refinance down the road and lock in an even lower rate. But I would take the sure thing of low rates now on a fixed rate loan. With regards to your second concern, I think that is potentially a legitimate concern. It all comes back to you know, how much leverage he's using to buy all these real estate investments and what kind of cash flow he has personally. You know, he sounds like a savvy guy. It sounds like he's doing what you do to build wealth in America, which is to buy ownership investments. He's putting money in his 401k plan. He's hopefully buying stock with that, and he's buying real estate. And over the long haul, decades from now, he should be able to look back and see that he's done very well. But I understand your concern. You don't want him to be over leveraged and so laden with debt that if he hits a tough time, he might actually lose some of these properties. And that is happening to some people right now. And so I think your concern is well founded. And I'd encourage you to talk to him about it and encourage him to take a look at that. You certainly use books like mine. He could sit down with a personal financial advisor to ask that question of. And if he does that, make sure that he hooks up with someone who charges on an hourly basis and, isn't selling products or other services.
Yeah. Thank you, Nate. Good luck. Eric Tyson, our guest today, Let's Get Real About Money, the title of his latest book. It's Profit from the Habits of the Best Personal Finance Managers, published by FT Press. Glad to have him along. And Mike in Stevens Point has a question for you, Eric. So let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. Thanks a lot for the show.
Sure.
Here's my question. About 8 months ago, at the age of 26, I decided to go into an investment, which, you buy the life insurance, and the life insurance makes money off of the mutual funds, and it also serves as your retirement as you move forward. And I guess I wanted to just get a clarification from the guest, and I've heard a lot of things about that not being the best option and not being a real smart move, and I guess I just wanted to hear his advice on, this versus a Roth. I understand the Roths are, the money is tax-free when you pull it out. And I guess just the differences on that. I mean, I do have a 401k, so this isn't only these aren't my only investments, but, this is my main one, and I'd like to make sure I'm making the right move.
Are you married, by the way, Mike, or we have children?
No, I'm not married. I'm single.
Okay.
And are you maxing out your 401k at this point?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, I have to tell you, and I write about this extensively in my books. I'm not a fan of these cash value life policies. They're probably the most oversold insurance product known to mankind, and agents love to sell them because they provide the agent with big commissions. The problem that I have, and you've kind of alluded to this in your question, is that you have other retirement accounts as options. The Roth IRA, for example, would be superior because when the investment earnings come out of the Roth IRA, they're not taxed, and that stands in stark contrast to this cash value life policy, whereupon at withdrawal you would pay taxes at the very high ordinary income tax rates on withdrawals. The other problem that I have with these policies is that because they are so expensive, they often lead people to buy less life insurance coverage than what they really need. If you don't have financial dependence at this point, you don't need life insurance. So you're spending money on something that sounds like you may not even need at this point. If you do need life insurance, you can get far more bang for your buck by buying term life insurance. I would keep the investing separate. I would, use the 401k. If you want to put more money away, you could do an IRA. You could do a variable annuity at a no-load company like Vanguard. But I would stay away from these cash value policies.
So, the thing I'm looking at, if I pull it out, is a pretty big loss. I mean, mm-hmm. I know I've only been in it for a little while, but you think it's best I just take that loss and move on?
Well, the loss is an illusion, and it's an illusion because the reason it shows you that there's these, supposedly high early surrender charges is that the agent has been paid a hefty commission. That money's gone no matter how you slice it, and the only way that they can show over an 8 to 10 year period that early surrender charge disappears is that if they keep your money for a decade, then they've been able to earn a high enough return to justify paying the agent's commission. So I would say at a minimum, I would cease funding it. If you want to leave the money in there, you can do that. And I guess over time, that would give you some life insurance protection. But again, you got to ask yourself, do you need life insurance protection? And if the answer is no, then, why waste any money on life insurance? And I would take whatever small cash balance is in there. If you wanted to, you could roll it over into a no-load annuity. But I certainly would not continue to fund that or put new money into it.
Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Ron and Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Ron.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I'm one of those minority that's right now carrying way, way, way too much credit card debt.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of resulted from rebuilding and remodeling an older home and turned out to be way over budget, surprise, surprise, like they usually do. I've since then, now it's done, of course, I've cut up all the credit cards, the best defense of the scissors. My question is, what is better for your credit card or your credit rating? As you pay off a credit card, do you leave the account open or do you close the account? There seems to be two views on that.
Well, there's not a, you know, without going into a lot more detail about the rest of your situation, it's not a completely simple matter. I mean, banks are, the credit agencies are going to be looking at a number of things. First, they're going to look at the level of debt that you have on all your cards in relation to the credit limit. And, you know, are you tapped out? Obviously, if someone has, you know, three credit cards with, you know, $5,000 limits and they've maxed out all of them, that's not a good thing. So I would work at paying off the highest interest rate cards first. And then as you do that, if you want to keep the card open for a period of time, that can be a thing that can help your credit rating. The concern, though, I have about you doing that is that since you've had this propensity to run up debt on the cards, I don't want that temptation to be there. So my preference would be to say I'd like to see you whittle down. How many cards did you say you had?
Oh, there's about four of them.
Or, I mean, that concerns me, and I think that just provides a lot of temptation. I'd like to see you over time, you know, get down to one or two cards, and ideally have a debit card. I don't think you need, you know, the thing about your credit rating, you know, the greatest danger to your credit rating in the future years is that you have so much debt, you may miss payments, have late payments. That kind of action is really going to damage your credit score. That's the greatest concern that I would have, in addition to the total amount of debt that you have. Those are the two biggest things that are going to really hurt your credit rating. So getting that debt level down to a much more manageable level will do good things for your credit, not to mention your future financial health and peace of mind.
And, Eric, what about the possibility of a second mortgage on the home and then using the mortgage to pay off those credit cards because the money did go toward a house?
Yeah, no, that can be a sensible strategy, you know, because you're trading high cost consumer debt, which is not tax deductible, for mortgage debt, which should be at a lower interest rate and should also be tax deductible. Generally speaking, that can be an okay thing to do, but you know, a couple concerns or dangers here. One is that if you do that, you know, you got to make sure that you don't run the credit card debt back up again.
Right.
Get yourself on a debit card program so the temptation's gone. And then secondly, you got to recognize the very real risk. And, you know, some of the homes that are ending up in foreclosure right now are people who've done just this strategy, in fact, you know, multiple times. And, you know, they depleted their home equity, ended up with too much debt, and then ended up losing the house or choosing to walk away from it because the house went down in value and was worth less than what they owed on it. So, you know, you want to protect your house. It's a special asset. You know, make sure that you can really afford the total debt that you're taking on the house.
All right. Good luck, Ron.
Okay, thank you.
Dave in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, guys. Thanks a lot for taking the call.
Sure.
So my situation is I have a private practice that used to be my main income earning, and then a few years ago I switched to being a contract employee for an agency. As a contract employee, I don't work more than half time, so I'm not entitled to their investment benefit, but it's my main income. So I've got all this money coming in, and I'm looking for retirement vehicles, and I'm wondering how to do that. With my private practice, I had a SEP IRA, simple IRA set up, and it worked pretty well, but now I'm not earning much money there. So I've got all this money coming in, and I don't quite know how to invest it.
Well, when you file your taxes with this income, how are you filing those taxes?
If I understand the question, I think it's as a contract employee.
All right, so you're an employee. You can't file then as a sole proprietor or small business owner. You're filing as a. You know, it sounds like you kind of got the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
You're an employee, but you don't have any of the benefits.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I would try to work with your employer over time to see if there's a way to address that, because you want to have access to, you want to be able to put money into one of these retirement savings plans. If they have a 401k plan, then ideally, you know, you'd like to be able to take advantage of that. If not, then you'd want to be able to treat that as self-employment income potentially, and that way you could dump a large portion of it into a KEO or a SEP IRA. So I would try talking to your benefits department to see if you could go down one of those two avenues. If that's not going to be possible and you still want to stay there, then, you know, and see, this is one of the unfortunate realities of our ridiculously complicated and convoluted tax code, is that you may only be able to fund an IRA, mm-hmm. you know, put $4,000 or $5,000 a year into it, depending upon your current age, and which is really unfair, because if you compare that with someone who has a 401k or a SEP IRA or a KEO, that's a small fraction of what a lot of other people can put away. But that, it is what it is.
Okay. So the best thing is to work with the employer and see if they'll flex with me.
Yeah, and if they can't, you can certainly set up an investment program on your own. But you know, you're going to be limited the size of the contribution
right.
with the IRA.
Yeah. Good. That's helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Kim in East Troy, your turn now. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Good morning. We're just starting to save for our children's education. They're ages 2 and 8. We're looking at putting about $100 a month away for each of them to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And we're wondering what is the best savings vehicle that will give us the best return, and whether or not that savings vehicle will change over time as our investment grows. Would it be a 529 plan? Would it be a Roth? We're a little lost.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, this can get complicated pretty quickly, and the reason being that it depends on do you want to put the money in the kids' names? You know, if you do that, there can be some adverse financial aid consequences. One of the things I really dislike about our financial aid policies and laws in this country, but the unfortunate reality is that the more money that you save in your child's name, the richer they're going to look.
Yeah.
when it comes time to apply for college. Now, some people say, well, now wait a minute. If you're going to start giving advice about, you know, how people can, you know, hide their money and get more financial aid, well, you know, it's not unlike our nation's tax system. There are rules, and if you understand how the rules work and you position your assets accordingly, there's nothing illegal about it. But I bring this up because some people do raise ethical concerns about doing it, and I bring this issue up because if the more money you put into your kids' names, the less likely they're going to be able to qualify for financial aid. So all things being equal, you're better off keeping money that you're earmarking for their college education in your name.
Mm-hmm.
It will be penalized less than if you put it into their name. I would say at their ages 2 and 8, you certainly want to be in some sort of a balanced vehicle, a mix of stocks and bonds. Some of the vehicles that are out there are static. It'll give you a fixed investment mix, 50-50, for the rest of time. You may want to put it into something that actually gets less aggressive the closer the kids get to college, or you can change it yourself. But, I wouldn't try to get too fancy with it. I think if you stick with a vehicle that's about a 50-50 mix between stocks and bonds, there's lots of good balance funds at companies like Vanguard, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price that'll fit the bill. I think that'll make it easier for you, and then you won't have to be tinkering with things every year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. The 520s, are they 529 or 527 accounts? 529s, yeah. At least those are not taxed
mm-hmm.
On the money you make.
Yeah, and they have some, yeah, and I'm glad you brought that back up again, because you know, the 529s, there are some potentially nice tax benefits. The thing that concerns me, though, about those accounts is that, I mean, well, if you're a wealthy person and you expect to get no financial aid, then putting money into a 529 is kind of a no-brainer, because you get the tax benefits and there's not going to be any financial aid consequences down the road if you can pay the full freight yourself. But, you know, most people, you know, if they're, you know, looking at sending their kid to a private college, which today is 40 to 50 grand a year, which is kind of a mind-boggling number already, and it's only going to get worse. Most people are going to need some financial aid, some financial assistance. The 529s can work against that, and that's what concerns me. You might be attracted to do the 529 to get a small tax benefit today, but there could be a fairly large negative consequence for financial aid down the road. So that's what concerns me about
it. Okay, got it. Bob in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
The question I had is, I have been unemployed for a period of about 18 months, and I did just receive a job offer I accepted, so I will be starting work in a few weeks here. But my question is, over this time of unemployment, we've managed to accumulate about $12,000 worth of credit card debt. Now, offsetting that, we actually have about the same amount of money still in savings. And I'm a little hesitant to take all that, the savings, and wipe out the credit card debt when I'm just starting out a new job. But I'm just looking for an opinion as to how to approach getting rid of this debt.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and I understand your reticence to use that savings money. But, you know, the thing you got to remember, I mean, the credit card interest rate is so much higher than the meager amount that your bank is paying you. And, you know, so I would take as much of that savings money as you're comfortable with and extinguish as much of that credit card debt as you possibly can. You know, I understand you don't want to deplete all of your emergency reserve, which that money sounds like it represents. On the other hand, you've got the credit card credit limit, which you've kind of used as emergency money anyway.
True.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you go back and I don't know how many months you've had that credit card debt and start to add up the total interest charges on that credit card debt, it begins, you know, I'm sure
it's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a lot of money, and it's painful to look at. So, you know, it's just, you know, credit cards are, you know, I understand, you know, you've gone through some tough times, and I'm sorry to hear about that, but I would take advantage of the savings that you do have and get rid of that as quickly as you possibly can, because then, you know, once you can get that credit card debt paid off and you're back into the employment situation, then you can start to funnel monthly savings into some sort of an account that gives you a tax benefit.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks for calling. And Don in Marquette, Michigan, it's your turn. Hi, Don.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. My question is this: dealing with a spouse who is resistant to talking with a financial advisor. I'm 50 years old, some credit card debt, $500,000 in retirement. My wife's a stay-at-home mom. Whenever I bring up talking about budget, we should really work at this, her hair just bristles. She doesn't want to talk about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, are you aware, do you have any ideas on strategies how to approach this and convince maybe an unwilling spouse that, hey, we, you know, we really need to do this?
Right. Well, it's a common problem, and the root of the problem, you know, the root of the problem more often than not is that, you know, she's probably looking at this thinking, you know, okay, oh, you have an agenda here. You have your way of managing me, and you want to take me to this person who's going to take your side and convince me. It's going to be two against one. That's probably the fear or concern. So I think your approach is, you know, how you approach this is important, and you might present it to her like, you know, look, there's, you know, we don't agree about all things financial. I'd like to find a way that we can, you know, work together better on this. I don't know how you've approached it, or and I'm not insinuating that you're doing it the wrong way, but you have to be really careful, because if you take more responsibility for this stuff, you have more knowledge, you know, it can be threatening to the other spouse, and they may not want to stop doing the things that they're doing, and they may see that as a threat. So you might introduce, you know, a variety of possible ways to come to an agreement on this stuff. You know, whether it could be going to a financial counselor, you could suggest interviewing several people and, you know, throw out to her that, you know, she could certainly come up with some of the people to talk to. You could read some books together. You could take a class together. Just make sure, you know, all of those, there are good resources out there and there's bad resources out there. You got to make sure that you're going to, you know, get advice or information from a resource that's helpful and looking out for your best interests.
Yeah. And you might want to pick up a copy of Eric's book, Let's Get Real About Money.
There's a lot of material in there on this very topic. But again, you have to be careful, because it's like, you know, if you too enthusiastically are pushing for one counselor or for one book or for one class, you know, it's probably going to naturally raise her suspicions, like, oh, well, this person probably just agrees with,
yeah,
you know, with you.
Thanks for calling, Don. Good luck. And Eric, thank you so much. I hope we have a chance to visit again.
Yeah, I do too. Boy, you have a very popular program, and I love being on your show. You have some great listeners with great questions, and I enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks very much. We'll try and get you back then. Eric Tyson is our guest today. It was some great information from him. His title of his latest book is Let's Get Real About Money. It's published by FT Press. Pleased to have him along. We'll try and get him back and talk some more. Certainly lots of great questions. Coming up, though, we're going to take a look at Youth at Risk of Future Crimes with Ken Strait, professor, associate professor in the UW-Madison Law School. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.